In the new book, The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African American Family, Gail Lamette Buckley, daughter of performer and activist Lena Horne, delves deep into her family history, detailing the experiences of an extraordinary African American family from the Civil War to Civil Rights. Beginning with her great-great-grandfather Moses Calhoun, a house slave who used the rare advantage of his education to become a successful businessman in post-war Atlanta, Buckley follows her family's two branches, one that stayed in the South and the other that settled in Brooklyn. Gail Lamette Buckley is the author of two previous books, The Horns, An American Family, which became a PBS American Masters documentary, and the bestseller American Patriots, the story of blacks in the military from the Revolution to Desert Storm. The new book, The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African American Family. The book is published by Grove Atlantic, and we welcome Gail Lamette Buckley to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, I'm very happy to be with you.
What brought you to this story, your own story, and looking into the family history?
Well, I've always been fascinated by family history, and turns out that every book I've ever written, I've had three books published, have always been about my family. And I find it fascinating, and I was fascinated by the fact that this was material I hadn't seen before, that that started in 1865 and went on to, I thought that 100 years of the civil rights century, I would call it, 1865 to 1965, was fascinating, especially seen through the eyes of a single family, half of whom lived in the North and half of whom lived in the South.
You do begin with your great-great-grandfather, Moses Calhoun. Give us a bit of that story and why that was a good place to start.
Well, Moses was basically the founding father of the, there was a founding mother, his grandmother, who'd been an extraordinary woman, who bought her own freedom before the Civil War and moved to Chicago. But Moses, her grandson, had a sister and a mother, and they all three were owned by a man called Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun, who was a second cousin of John C. Calhoun and a physician in Atlanta. And they sort of had a family business with Calhoun. Moses was the butler. His mother was the cook, and his sister was the nursemaid. When freedom came, Moses had a sort of head start because Andrew Bonaparte Calhoun had educated him because he wanted a literate butler, even though it was against the law for any black, slave or free, in the South to be educated. But Calhoun was powerful enough to avoid that. And so my great-great-grandfather had an education. And when freedom came, he was ready to sort of attend to the American dream. He became, by 1886, 20 years after the end of the war, he was called by the Atlanta Constitution the richest colored man in Atlanta. So he really had made a life for himself and for his children. He had two daughters, Lena and Cora, who were beautiful and brilliantly educated in the missionary schools that opened up all over the South after the war. The missionary schools were started by white Northern philanthropists and were staffed by white teachers who instilled in these young people who had been called inferior all of their lives by the white power structure that they were indeed not inferior people. So they had strict academics and this sense that they had a duty to they were going to be the first black teachers in the South. That was why they were trained. And that's where both of Moses' daughters went, to Atlanta University, and the other daughter went to Fisk, where W.E.B. Du Bois fell madly in love with her. But she did not marry him, and he was heartbroken.
Your story follows the family's two branches, one that stayed in the South and the other that settled in Brooklyn. Give us a sense of how the other branch made it to Brooklyn.
Well, after Plessy versus Ferguson, Cora Horne, who was one of Moses' two daughters, went north with her husband, who was called Edwin Horne, who had been a politician, a Republican activist in the South, who came north and changed his political affiliation. He became a Democrat once he got to New York City because he saw where the power was. he joined something called Black Tammany and became so important to Black Tammany in the 1910 election that his pamphlets encouraged black men to vote for Democrats for the first time. And there was a Democratic governor for the first time since before the Civil War. All of this because of my great-grandfather's pamphlets. So they sort of followed their bliss in a way to be successful careerists. And my great-grandmother was even more extraordinary in the sense that she was a suffragist and a feminist, and she remained a Republican. She'd had scorn for Tammany because she remembered the draft riots, and she remained a Republican, the party of Lincoln, and became a Republican activist of a truly energetic sort in the years of World War I and the 1920s.
And in that time, was there a path? Was there something they were ultimately searching for?
Well, I think they were searching to uplift the race. That was what they were meant to do. Du Bois had called them the talented 10th, the 10% of the black population who were meant to uplift the other 90%. They were the highly educated members of the black community. My great-grandparents were very serious about that, as was their father, Moses. So it was a sense of this is what they had a duty to be educated and to pass it on, to teach and to instruct in some way or other.
When you wanted to write this book, did that come out of writing The Horns? I mean, was this something that you wanted to follow up more in the family history?
Well, it did in the sense that actually I didn't have any of the information about the Southern family, or very little, when I wrote The Horns. And then after my mother died, I found all this stuff that the Southern part of the family had been sending to her. And I was fascinated by it because in those days, in the days before email, people saved everything, letters, newspaper clippings, booklets. And I had this incredible treasure trove of Southern middle-class black life, which I thought was just extraordinary. And it seemed to me that in a way, obviously, they were more unlucky living in the South because there were whites-only signs everywhere for people bringing up their children had to face that. But it seems that the marriages were happier, the families were bigger. They were equally as successful in the South as they had been in the North. So it was an interesting, it was an eye-opener to me once I did that research.
And you do set, as I mentioned in the title of the book, you do set a time frame from the Civil War to civil rights, and it's a fascinating projection, isn't it?
Well, yes, it was amazing to me how it all sort of fell into place. I could follow this family in Atlanta from 1865 to 1965, and then follow them also in the North when, at the turn of the century, half of the family moved north, and they were equally successful, both sides of the family. And that was what struck me as amazing, because I'd expected the Southern family to be, maybe they were oppressed, they would not be as successful, but they were, because they were entrepreneurs and doctors and business people and teachers, and they had a wonderful world and a wonderful life, which I felt was surprising. Obviously, they had social problems and political problems that they couldn't deal with, but they managed quite successfully by turning inward into family and friends and community and club, and especially church. There was one church that they all went to, all the generations in Atlanta, the First Congregational Church, and that was fascinating.
It is fascinating in reading the story because it's impossible not to read and compare the stories between those who were in the North and those who were in the South.
They were more politically free, obviously, in the North, and this is why the northern part of the family went into politics and had public lives, publicly successful lives, and the family in the South tended to be, for example, one of my favorite family members was the longest practicing black doctor in Georgia and the longest practicing a doctor of any race in Atlanta. So these are people who gave back to the community, both in the North and in the South.
How much, and I know you went through this, I heard you talk about it once, about going and researching the first book, of learning what is true and what is family lore.
Well, it is difficult because sometimes the family members, you know, exaggerate stories or forget stories or whatever. And I think I was fortunate in that there were so many newspaper clippings that most of the family lore could be soothed out and seen as truth. What I wasn't sure about, I could find a lot that was seemed to be true.
And what, of course, is fascinating about your story and the story that you tell and your mother's story is that she was really shuttled back between these lives in North and South.
She was until she was basically, let me see, from 1923 to 1929. 1923, I think she was seven. She was born in 1917. So she was torn between the North and the South by her mother and grandmother. Her mother was a Northerner of a family that had always been free from Massachusetts, but she was an actress, a failed actress, and the only acting she could really get were in tent shows in the South where they recreated theatrical classics and took them touring in the South. And she would take Lena with her, my mother, and part of the time. And this was very upsetting to my mother's grandmother, who was the daughter of Moses Calhoun and believed totally in education, because Lena had been educated in the North, in Brooklyn, in an ethical culture nursery school, in a Roman Catholic grade school. And then she went to the South and was educated in one-room schoolhouses with children who hated her. So that was the story.
How hard was it for a woman like Cora Calhoun to be a feminist and a suffragette in this time, and what she was able to accomplish in that time?
She was able to accomplish it because she lived in the North and because finally women got the vote. But even before she had the vote, she was on the board of the Big Brothers and Big Sisters. She was a mentor to Paul Robeson, who was a young man who'd lost his mother. She was on the board of the Mayor's Victory Committee in World War I. She was on the Urban League. She was on the NAACP. She joined anything she could join. That was what she did, which her Southern counterparts, her cousins in the South, could not do. They had to be club women in the South, black club women in the South, were concerned with things like horticulture and arts and their travels abroad. They could not do the sort of do-gooding, uplifting that people in the North could do. That was one of the drawbacks of living in the South. It's very conscripted what they could do.
Describe a little bit the relationship between Cora Calhoun and her daughter, your grandmother.
My mother's grandmother was Cora Calhoun, and Cora Calhoun totally. Lena was educated. That was what it was all about. She was not a warm, loving person, yet she never raised her voice. It was always about, Lena, what are you reading? Are you saying your prayers? Are you doing your duty? I mean, it was a very strict, old-fashioned kind of relationship, which I think was the pattern in those days. There wasn't a lot of touchy-feely loving going on in middle-class families, white or black. It was very much about children knew their place. They were seen and not heard. She took my mother to meetings of the Baha'i. She was a Baha'i person. She'd been a Congregationalist, then she became a Roman Catholic, then she became a ethical culturist, then she became a Baha'i person. She was a spiritual seeker as well as a political seeker all her life. And she took Lena to club meetings and said, do not speak unless you're spoken to. Do not look people in the eye when you shake their hands. It was all about behavior. She made her a member, a lifetime member of the NAACP at the age of two. So that's a bit, that shows the kind of person Cora Calhoun Horn was.
You touch on in this book, and you talk about in the Horns, that this really allowed your mother to create a sort of dual personality, that Southern personality and then also one that allowed her to be more real when she was in Brooklyn. Did you see that growing
up? She did have two personalities. I know two personalities, but definitely two personas. When she would come home to her grandmother after being in the South with her mother, her grandmother would really try to erase her Southern accent. And my mother stressed her Southern accent when she was in the South because she wanted to make the children like her, and the children hated everything about her, and her accent was one of the things they hated. So so she had to learn to be Southern. And then it helped her later on when she was touring army camps. She would let that Southern side of her personality come out when she was performing, which she never did in private life. In private life, she was very Northern.
You obviously have a fascination and a great interest in your family history. How much does the rest of your family, even your mother, have in that history?
Well, my mother was fascinated by the history because she didn't know it. And I was fascinated because I didn't know it. And I think it all had to do with, it happened to me, you know, in the 1960s, we suddenly realized that there was such a thing as black history. I had no idea there were blacks in the Revolution, for example. I had no idea, I didn't know about the Tuskegee Airmen, who had been the queen of the 99th Pursuit Squadron. And these were all things that she knew a little bit about, but she had no, and things that she'd been told about by her grandparents, but neither of us really knew. And I think that's why black history is so important. I disagree with people who say it shouldn't be taught or it shouldn't be separate. I'm not sure that I believe in hyphenated, I don't believe in hyphenated nationalities, but I do believe that we need to know the history of every ethnic group in this country, because I think it brings us together more than separates us, to know that other people have contributed. It just wasn't contributed by old white men, as it were, to use a cliche.
You're ultimately looking at five generations in this book.
Five or six, yeah.
And was there a natural place for you of a start and an end point?
Yeah, 1865 was a start. I said, let's start with freedom. 1965 with the Civil Rights Act. Let's start with that. End with that was my. And then, of course, I have a coda of the 1980s with my mother, who had a huge success in her one-woman show in the 1980s. And with Dr. Nash in the South, who was, when he died, the Atlanta Constitution said it's the end of an era, because he was such an extraordinary person who was beloved in both communities, white and black.
White and black.
Yeah.
Did your mother help you understand that those worlds of straddling that line of white and black?
Well, she certainly had to do it her entire life. She started as a child doing it because the club meetings that her grandmother took her to were integrated. And my grandmother, her grandmother was a great believer in integration. So she'd always done it. And when she went to Hollywood, she did it. And in her career, she did it. So it was something that she had done all her life. And it's partly of growing up in New York. She went to a girls' high school, which in those days was totally integrated. She went to a Catholic church, which had a white pastor. It was a black church, but it had a white pastor. And her favorite teacher at girls' high school was white. So she'd known this world all her life. She was never brought up in a totally strictly segregated society.
In reading The Black Calhouns, you can't help but be fascinated by the names and the major figures that pop up in the story. You mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois, Langston Hughes. It's fascinating. This cast of characters is pretty incredible.
Yes, it was exciting to really discover that those people were known. I mean, the fact that Du Bois was madly in love with my grandmother's great-grandmother's sister, I just thought was delightful, and he wrote about her. And Langston Hughes, of course, was a great friend of my great-uncle, my mother's uncle, who was Frank Horn, who was a sort of second-tier Harlem Renaissance figure, a poet, and also a member of FDR's black cabinet. So this was all, and where she lived in the South when he was dean of the Fort Valley Industrial College there and acting president. So these were people who were part of the family, as it were. And Paul Robeson, of course, her grandmother had been his mentor when he was a teenager. So all of these people were part of her family, in our family life.
One of the things that I want to end with is, as I mentioned, the story goes over five, even as you say, six generations, and over that period of time, when it comes to racism and of course the story of the history of racism and black history, as you mentioned, do you see optimism? Do you see that there is improvement in this time and even where we are now that allows us to have optimism?
Well, I think there are periods of optimism. In the 70s, there was certainly optimism. It's certainly in Atlanta, which suddenly had a black mayor and incredible black participation in what was going on in the city. I think we seem to take two steps forward and one step backwards constantly, and there seems to be a cycle. I think the cycle now is horrible. It seems to be that racism is back. I mean, it never went away, obviously, but people, there was a period when it was, people were not, could not so easily express their open racism as they seem to be able to do now or want to do now. And I think that's too bad.
And that is in the age of an African-American president of the United States.
Yes, I think it was partly brought on by an African-American president because the Republican, certain members of the Republican Party made it clear that they disliked Obama because he was black. And even though they could pretend to say it was his liberalism, whatever it is they didn't like, but everybody could read between the lines. And so the racists came out of the woodwork.
Will you continue to write about your family's history?
I don't think so. I don't think I'm going to. I'm 78 years old. I don't think I'm going to write another book. I'm happy to live my life, actually. It's very tiring.
Well, that is good for you, a shame for us, but certainly good for you. The name of the book is The Black Calhouns, From Civil War to Civil Rights with One African-American Family. The book is published by Grove Atlantic. Gail Lamette Buckley, I thank you very much for spending time with us. What a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, I thank you very much. I'm very grateful that you asked me to be on your program.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is The Black Calhouns by Gail Lamette Buckley. It is published by Grove Atlantic. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.